This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You remember that game we used to play, What is Janet Yellen Thinking? Well, here you go. Way more than five words, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the second day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Janet Yellen has had a pretty busy week or so. The G20 finance ministers meeting in India this past weekend, then a 10-hour train ride into Kyiv, 12 surprise hours on the ground on Monday, then 10 hours in a train back out, the long flight home, and everybody back in the office the next day. She and I talked about all that in the Treasury building this morning before we turned the microphones on. And once we did, question number one was about that trip to Kyiv and the war in Ukraine and what Yellen calls this country's moral obligation to help, even as Speaker Kevin McCarthy and some Republicans in the House make it clear they would like to tighten their grip on the purse strings.
Well, first of all, I do believe we have a moral obligation to help a country and its people who are utterly courageous in fighting against a brutal and unprovoked attack on them, which threatens not only that country and its people, but also raises a threat to many other countries if we don't stand up against this kind of aggression. We haven't seen anything like this in Europe in decades, and it really is a violation of all that we stand for. And so it is in our interest to stand up against it. And, you know, Senator McConnell has made clear that he strongly supports and believes in our obligation to help Ukraine. Many Republicans, as well as Democrats, congressional delegations, have visited Ukraine and expressed their support. So my belief is that there is broad bipartisan support for helping Ukraine for as long as it takes.
All of that said, though, do you suppose possibly you and the president are setting yourselves up to fail if you can't bring Speaker McCarthy on board?
Well, we're going to do everything we can to convince members of Congress that this is a priority we must support and is very much in our interest.
While you were there and in that op-ed, you talked a lot about the economic imperative for the Ukrainian economy, right? And how war, while a horrible humanitarian disaster and a national security challenge, is fundamentally an economic challenge as well. And I guess my question is, there will be trillions of dollars in capital infrastructure costs necessary to rebuild Ukraine, in addition to the many more billions that we're surely going to give them in economic assistance and national security assistance. When you say we're there for as long as it takes, are you there for as much money as it takes as well?
Well, our focus right now is on the short-term budget needs that Ukraine has in order to be able to go on providing the social services, schooling, first responders.
You visited a school when you were there.
I did visit
a
school.
Like?
It was a very moving experience. We met with teachers, one whose husband for the second time was called off to fight, a teacher with two children she's left alone to take care of, and these are people who... Now, the day that we were there, the electricity was functional all day, but I visited they call them point of invincibility. They have established essentially tents, heated tents, where people can go when they can't cook food, the electricity is out, they need to charge a cell phone, they need to get warm. There's a great sense of community, but an enormous amount of trauma that everyone in Ukraine is experiencing, even if they're not in the middle of the fighting.
You've talked a lot about economic sanctions, denying the Russians the ability to wage the war that they've kind of been doing. But the International Monetary Fund the other day said reasonably positive things about the Russian economy. Yes, we have sanctions. Yes, you're devoted to pursuing them. But it certainly seems like, for now, they're not doing what you want them to do.
You're asking me about Russia.
I am asking you about Russia. Yes, ma'am.
So the numbers like GDP growth in Russia have been more positive than we and the IMF had forecast.
And probably hoped, right?
Well, let me say, what we hope is that we can deny Russia access to the revenues that they need to fight this war and to the goods that they need to supply their military. So that's our focus. Now, they have been devoting substantial resources to trying to support their economy. That's come at the cost of very large budget deficits that were unanticipated for them, and they're running down some of the assets that they had built up to use as buffers. So they are trying to keep their economy moving forward and to cushion the domestic blows from our sanctions. But when you come back to, are we denying them, are we degrading their military readiness and capability, the answer is clearly yes. The equipment that they have lost, over 9,000 pieces of equipment, including tanks, they're having a tremendously difficult time replacing. Sanctions have meant that most countries able to supply the semiconductors that go into this equipment, they don't have access to that. They're turning to countries like Iran and North Korea, who are hardly preferred providers of this equipment, and it's clear that they are running short of the material that you need to wage war. And our sanctions on their oil has almost halved their revenues over the last year from oil sales, which is a critical source of support. So we are reducing their revenues, and we are impacting their ability to wage war.
You and I have spoken several times, and this is the first time I think you've ever come close to thumping the table in an answer.
Well, I feel very strongly about this. This is a brutal and unprovoked attack against innocent, democratic people who are showing incredible courage and great resilience in fighting an enemy that few imagined they would be able to effectively confront. And the stand that they are taking is critically important to all democratic countries in preserving our way of life and supporting our values and an international order that runs according to fundamental human rights principles.
Last question on the global economy, and then I want to turn to domestic affairs. I want to talk about China for a second. Much in the news, Congress is agitated about it. The president, of course, is taking action against the Chinese, specifically with technology, but in a lot of other sectors. I wonder if you believe the global economy is ready for the two biggest economies on the planet to not be getting along really well.
Well, I think it's important that China and the U.S., as the world's two leading economies, attempt to at least put a floor under their relationship.
That's an interesting phrasing, that we're putting a floor under this economic relationship, arguably the most important economic relationship in the world.
Well, it's important that we do get along. We have our differences clearly. We're concerned about China's behavior, both in national security context and also economic practices that we think are harmful, and we need to address those things. But for the sake of our own countries and the globe, we also need to get along. We've agreed on issues like the global macro environment, mm-hmm. which we both influence greatly. We need to talk about these things and understand what we need to do to provide for healthier growth. And in issues like climate change, where we all have an interest in addressing it, pandemics, we need to make preparations so that we're prepared for a future pandemic. These are issues where we need to work together for the sake of the entire globe. And I hope that we'll be able to resume discussions. I've started discussions with my counterparts in China and hope to be able at an appropriate time to resume them.
We will also resume at an appropriate time, Secretary Yellen and I, with what she is thinking about the American economy. Again, it's going to be way more than five words. That's just the way she rolls. It's coming up after the fold. Wall Street on this Thursday, traders had a little giddy up late in the day. Details, numbers, when we get there. You'll hear this again in a little bit right at the bottom of the numbers if I have enough time, but it is worth doubling down on. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note topped 4% today, still low-ish by long-term historical standards, but right at the top of its trading range the past decade or so. So there is that. The other notes of note are 2-year Treasuries, yields on which hit a 16-year high today, 4.9%, which, if you do the math, puts it almost a full percentage point higher than the longer maturity 10-year. This sounds geeky, I know, but hear me out, would you? Because usually yields, another way to say interest rates, are higher the longer the maturity of the bond. That is, the government usually has to pay you more to borrow your money for 10 years, because that's what a bond is, right? You're lending the government money. And if you're going to do it for 10 years, it usually costs the government more than it would for a 2-year note. That is called the yield curve, the difference between those two yields. But what we've got now is exactly the other way around, what is called an inverted yield curve. And that usually is a very not good thing. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what is going on.
Humans have been fortune-telling for at least 6,000 years. There's tarot cards, palm reading, and the bond market. A 10-year bond theoretically locks up your money for 10 years in exchange for some yield or other. Is that yield worth it to you? It depends on what the future looks like. Inflation, interest rates.
The long-term real growth potential of the U.S. economy.
Steve Lightley is with BlackRock. The bond market has to predict all of this. Now, in good times, the longer the bond, the higher the yield. Partly because the future looks bright.
Inflation expectations are expected to remain firm. Growth is expected to remain resilient. The Federal Reserve is likely to be raising interest rates.
Matthew Luzzetti is at Deutsche Bank. But sometimes everything gets turned upside down. The longer-term bonds start showing a lower return than the short-term bonds. It's called inversion. Basically, this is when the fortune teller goes quiet, looks terrified, and some doves fall out of the sky.
Inversions predate the recession anywhere from 6 to 18 months.
Steve Bliss is with T.S. Lombard. Short-term bonds represent the present when the Fed is raising rates. Long-term bonds show a dark and terrible future where the Fed is lowering rates because we're in recession. But there's a little more to an inversion.
It's not like it's a middle-aged talisman, like a whale washing up on the beach and you get 7 years of bad luck. There's something real going on in the marketplace.
The economy sours on making long-term investments and sticks with low-risk, short-term ones.
People are being compensated more to take no risk.
Enough people do that, and it starves the economy of credit, creating an economic slowdown, he says. So the inverted yield curve isn't just a prophecy, it can be a self-fulfilling one, too. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The yield curve and things falling out of the sky only on Marketplace. Coming up.
We're a country that since 1789 has always paid our bills.
So far, that is, the Treasury Secretary on the debt limit. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 341 today, 1%, 33,003. The NASDAQ added 83 points, just shy of 0.75%, 11,462. The S&P 500 picked up 29 points, 0.75%, 39,081. Last week's first-time claims for unemployment benefits came in at 190,000. That is down 2,000 from the week before. Traders took a look at that and said, oh, yeah, the Fed's going to keep raising rates. So bank stocks had a bad day. J.P. Morgan Chase dipped 1%. Wells Fargo gave almost 1 9/10%. Morgan Stanley fell about 0.1%. Salesforce predicts its profits this year will easily beat expectations. Shares in the cloud software provider added 11.5%. Extra points if you can tell me exactly what Salesforce does. Bond prices, as promised, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.06%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl from Macy's and Best Buy. Today, Tim, quarterly earnings reports, data from a couple of the stores where people were buying a lot of the stuff we were buying early in the pandemic, electronics and clothing and the like. And both of those companies said the same thing today, pretty much the same thing, that those kinds of sales are finally starting to fall as consumers adjust to inflation. Retailers like Walmart and Target, meanwhile, that also sell groceries, are doing a little bit better. If you look at it real close, it's kind of a needs versus wants thing. Marketplace of Savannah Marr asked some consumers where they were pulling back.
Freelance writer Abigail Geiger's housing costs in Orlando basically doubled in the last year. So she's been spending a lot of time with her budgeting spreadsheet.
I sat down with myself and I was like, okay, this is going to be a really frugal year, 2 years.
Her Spotify subscription was the first to go, then her gym membership. And she's not going out as much.
If it's like a special occasion or someone's in town, I'll definitely do that. But I'm not about to go have a random cocktail that ends up costing like $25.
The takeout budget has been an obvious target for downsizing in Jennifer Lee's household.
In my humble opinion, I think food prepared by someone else always tastes better.
Lee is a senior economist at BMO Capital Markets, and she says extra pandemic savings and pent-up demand have kept consumer spending on extras surprisingly resilient. But inflation and higher interest rates are catching up with us. She sees signs we're starting to pull back on travel, entertainment.
Even things like clothing. I mean, of course, we all need clothes, but do you need that new outfit from insert designer name here, you know?
And some consumers' personal definition of discretionary is shifting. Like Val Harrington, a PhD student living in Baltimore.
I'm actually like kind of a fiend for goat cheese.
Which she used to consider an occasional treat at the grocery store. Now it's a rare luxury. Even Harrington's pets are making sacrifices.
Things like changing our cat's cat food brand to one that's a lot less expensive, even though previously we had been getting like pretty good quality food for them.
Higher human food prices plus housing and energy costs have her rethinking what goes on the necessities list. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
We weren't technically in her office this morning, Secretary Yellen and I, more like in an old conference room across a wide black and white tiled hallway, but After a review of America in the global economy, we turned inward. Here you go.
I need to tick through a couple of things on the domestic economy. First of all, inflation. There was a period, lasted a brief shining moment, where inflation looked like it was trending down. It is now trending back up. I wonder why you keep saying positive things about your hopes for the future of this economy when inflation certainly doesn't look like it has been taken care of.
Well, inflation remains too high, and it's President Biden's top economic priority to make sure that it comes down. Most of the work in doing that is allocated to the Federal Reserve, but there are additional steps we can and have taken to bring inflation down too.
Yeah, but why are you so hopeful about this economy when the indicators are consumers are anxious, inflation is ticking back up, and I don't want to get into the whole R-word thing, but people are talking about recession.
So I guess I would disagree with the characterization that inflation is moving in the wrong direction. Progress on inflation is not going to be a straight line. Broadly speaking, it's coming down, and we fully expect it to come down substantially further this year. Shelter costs have been contributing importantly to inflation. They clearly will be receding in the months ahead because the prices of new rentals have stabilized or even come down. Supply bottlenecks that were boosting transportation costs have diminished very substantially. Used car prices are coming down. We've managed to bring down and stabilize energy prices. And inflation is coming down, but it remains too high. It needs to be watched, but I believe it will continue to move down.
The labor market. I ask people on this program all the time if they can explain the labor market. You are a labor economist. I can think of nobody better to ask this question. Why isn't the labor market in this economy responding to what the Federal Reserve is trying to do? Slow it down and just take a pause.
So spending in this economy, the housing sector has weakened substantially as a consequence of the interest rate increases. Mm-hmm. But consumer spending remains solid. And
which is ordinarily a good thing unless you're trying to bring inflation down. And we're creating 500,000 jobs a month in this economy.
Well, look, that's 1 month, and that number can be highly distorted by seasonal fluctuations. We had a very warm January.
So, yeah, we did. So let me give you another one. First-time claims for unemployment benefits. Now 7 weeks in a row, under 200,000. They were down again this morning. The labor market is looking at the Fed going, eh.
So we do have a tight labor market. Firms have been trying very aggressively to hire. And the Fed probably needs to take a little bit of heat out of the labor market, but that doesn't mean that people need to lose their jobs. As growth slows, the intensity with which firms will try to hire, pushing up wages and possibly causing inflationary spillovers, that intensity is likely to diminish. And I continue to believe that it's possible to see inflation come down in the context of a labor market that remains healthy.
I have to ask you about the debt limit. I don't want to talk about minting the coin. I don't want to talk about whether or not it's a gimmick. I want to ask you this. Do you think that the way we treat our obligations in this country and the political ping pong ball that they become, do you suppose that makes us look unserious to the rest of the world?
Well, I think the rest of the world does become concerned when they see members of Congress threatening to prevent the United States from paying its bills. We're a country that since 1789 has always paid our bills, and they want to see a commitment from the United States, which is our treasuries are the world's safest asset. They want to know that Congress will never contemplate preventing us from paying our bills. And that's what raising the debt ceiling is about, is making it possible to pay the bills for expenses we've already incurred that have been decided by Congress.
Last question, obviously. With all respect, this has been an interview in which hope is playing a big factor. You hope the Russians, their economy is going to suffer more. You hope the Ukrainians are going to hold out. You hope that the Republicans in Congress are going to fund the Ukrainians. You hope inflation is going to come down. You hope Republicans in Congress are going to raise the debt limit. That's a lot of hope.
We're working toward those ends. It's not purely hope. It's also implementing policies, including sanctions, which Treasury is largely responsible for. And last week, we announced a host of additional sanctions on Russia that we think will make our sanctions more effective. And the purpose of my trip, a main purpose of my trip to Ukraine, was to show the American people what their support for Ukraine is buying, what a difference it makes. And I think the American people are generous and humanitarian, and when they understand what a difference our aid is making in enabling courageous people to continue to fight for their freedom and their right to self-determination, they will want to continue to provide that support, and it's our job to make that case.
Madam Secretary, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, two items about the Ford Motor Company. Item number one, Ford said today it's going to restart production of its all-electric F-150 pickup, the Lightning it's called, the gas-powered version of which is the best-selling vehicle, car or truck, in this country. That resumes on March the 13th. It'll been offline for about a month. Battery problems, it seems. Item two, this one's from Bloomberg. Ford has filed a patent for a technology that could remotely shut down your air conditioning in your car or lock you out of your car or make it beep forever if you miss a payment. In a statement not necessarily making this any less big brothery, the company said it has no plans to use that technology. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. A quick data point from the International Energy Agency, which said today that in 2022, global energy-related carbon emissions rose less than they had been thinking would be the case, less than 1% increase over 2021. We are using more oil and gas than usual, yes, but more renewables as well. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody, back in Los Angeles. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.